Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this brand new episode of Crystal Ball Clarity of It All. This episode, I get the honor of introducing a very special guest to me, and her name is Deborah Vick. So let's welcome Deborah to Crystal Ball Clarity of It All. Hello, lady. I am glad to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful, and thank you so much for having me here today. I'm so excited. I've been waiting for a while. You've been very busy, so I'm very excited to have an opportunity.
I have to say, I got so booked, and you know, I really have been embracing some boundaries around enjoying the holidays, even though I think I only had like a week off, literally, at most, but that week to me was so, so good. And you want to talk about busy. What about you? Okay. So first off, please tell everyone who you are and what you do.
Hello, I am Deborah Vick. I wear quite a few hats, actually. So I am an advocate for people in the disability community. I'm an empowerment coach and a mindfulness and mindset coach. Also a founder or co-founder of a nonprofit organization designed to empower people with disabilities while still creating inclusive and awareness programs to bring it to mainstream society, whether it's children to the medical community, really trying to reduce barriers to create more inclusive spaces for people. That's gist of what I do, but I also a mom, I'm an educator, I'm a scout leader. Obviously, I have multiple disabilities of my own, so I'm not just an advocate. I am a professional patient as well. So it is a balance between the work that I do as for empowerment coaching and motivational and keynote speaking and managing my own healthcare and, of course, my family and balancing with that. And I'm also a mom to a service dog and a cat as well. And married to my college sweetheart.
Oh, that is so sweet. And let's add, you're also an author in there as well. That is an add-in. And so you say that you're a professional patient. Is that how you put it? So can you explain to people what exactly that means for you personally? And, you know, my biggest question is, when did this all start for you as well? Like, what age did this start for you?
And it's funny when I say professional patient, because a number of the disability empowerment rooms where we focus on the positive mindset, but also acknowledge our challenges, we frequently say we're not medical professionals, we're professional patients. Ironically, the last hospitalization that I had, a doctor actually said to me, "You're a professional patient, we need to listen to you." And I almost fell over laughing because I've been saying that for so long.
Yeah.
So I remember as a kid, when I'd go and play soccer, my ankles would turn all the time. And we just run on the side of my ankles, or I'd sit frog-legged all the time and never even thought about it. It was just a natural thing. Even now, I sometimes sit frog-legged and then I got to pull my legs back out of it because they're stuck. But I had a very active young childhood. Right? My dad and my mom is a nurse and my dad's a retired teacher and coach. So as long as I can remember, I had soccer balls, or cross sticks, hockey sticks, you know, basket. I don't remember not having those things, right? And I hiked the Grand Canyon when I was 10 years old, and I hiked Zion and Bryce Canyon and many of the national parks. Wow. So I grew up being very physically active, and it wasn't until seventh grade that I landed in the pit doing the triple jump. And so that's like a tarmac runway almost, you know, you hop, skip, and jump, and you land in the sand pit. I hop, skipped, and jumped. My coach called my name. I turned. I didn't look where I was landing. Oh, yes. So a friend who witnessed it to this day is like, oh, every time we mention it, she's like cringes because she saw it. And from that day forward, I was on crutches. And I grew toughing it up, right? When I was a kid, I remember breaking my toe in a wave pool. Mind you, my dad didn't know it was broken. He thought I bruised it. And having walked around the amusement park all day to go back to the campsite, my whole foot swollen. I'm like, Dad, I think there's something going on here, a little bit more than a, you know, bruised toe. But I grew up with that kind of mentality, right? You get up, you push through it, you find a way, you know, when there's a will, there's a way kind of attitude, and you just make it happen. So we didn't really think much of it. You know, my dad and my mom, both having seen what happens to people when they have surgery young, wanted me to wait. So we tried physical therapy for 7th and 8th grade. Mind you, this was just after my bat mitzvah. And I only remember that because I carried the Torah. I was one of the first women to read the Torah for a bat mitzvah at my temple. It's a really big deal. And I had tiny pumps, but you can't drop the Torah. So I remember being this huge thing. And I was like, oh, at least I got to carry the Torah. When I damaged my knees, I'm like, well, I carried the Torah. And so I know it was right around my 13th birthday. I don't know like how close, but it was like, you know, in the March time period. So yeah, we're coming up to that date pretty close. And I was a crutches from the Torah. And each year in high school, we started doing surgery on one leg at a time. The idea was to see if we can fix one leg. And if it worked, we'd fix the other. But my kneecaps are floating now. Like nothing holds them in place. They can literally almost go sideways. You can practically put your hand under my kneecaps. They move so much. And we're not supposed to do the little tricks and stuff that our diseases allow us to do. They're called party tricks. And I would be able to turn my kneecap like almost on the side in the socket or people would come and play with it. Yeah, it's not really the way you're supposed to do it. And I kind of started realizing something was wrong when I saw people in physical therapy needing their legs bent. Right? The physical therapist, their body weight just to get a degree or two bending after an injury or after surgery. I had full range of motion. And here I was in straight leg braces for 2 years, full range of motion. Oh. I was on a special bus and I'd be able to like, I would just grab my leg brace and just pull my leg straight up in the air to let people by. It's like kind of like a gateway of my legs. And I never stiffened. And then I started having surgeries. And the idea was, I'm like, I'm just putting my leg up. It's like, I can see it. But the bone underneath the kneecap, they cut it off. And it over an inch, and they cut the tendon and they tighten. Well, a person without Ehlers-Danlos, it would tighten up. On me, it didn't. And when the nurse went to change the bandages, I had full range of motion. She kind of freaked, and the doctor should have realized something wasn't too kosher.
Right.
She's like, "Oh, this is good. You're flexible." I'm going, "I don't think I'm supposed to be flexible like this." And kept on doing surgeries and nothing ever got better. I only got worse. And ultimately I developed RSD. Well, then it was called sympathetic dystrophy. Now it's referred to as CRPS, chronic regional pain syndrome. As far as I can tell, I've been in remission for quite some time, but at the time it was really severe and I wasn't believed. I mean, I smile and I do things. And so I don't know how to be any different, right, than to just live the best version that I can at that moment, because that's the mentality that I was given and support that I was given early on in life. So I don't know how to be different than that. You know, the sit back, you know, the closest I come is playing my singing bowls to relaxation, right? Because I don't know how, I can't just sit still and not do something. So, you know, I wasn't believed. And eventually I had to get a very painful test. Like, is it 12-inch needle, sympathetic nerve block, you're awake for it. And you can tell them what nerves are hitting. And the first time they didn't hit the nerve, so the second time they did hit it, they saw the temperature difference. And it wasn't just one knee, it was both knees that had RSD. And with the RSD, it was so severe that what happened, so I'm gonna go back to that one, is when you have that disease, it's extraordinarily painful. And what happens is all the nerves in that area takes any sensation and registers it as pain. That includes your stocking. Anything. I mean, it was really severe, and it was the main reason why I ended up leaving New York, because it's also impacted by weather and pressure changes and everything else. And my father was trying to get me to move out. I was fighting it because I had created a great life in SUNY Albany. I was going for career politics. I was in a 3+3 program. I was in student government, assistant director of women's issues office. I mean, I had everything lined up, including PAC money for when I wanted to run for political office, because I had helped found the chapter of the National Women's Caucus on Long Island. So I was a senior in high school. They didn't know that when they elected me vice chair. They had to go back and edit the bylaws because they thought I was a senior in college, not a senior in high school. I thought it was kind of funny because my dad was driving me to the meetings. So I'm kind of like, you know, I don't think I'd have my dad drive me, but okay. So, you know, I had everything set up, and I was even asked to run for student body president the year that I ended up leaving. But my dad knew I needed to not leave, and I didn't want to leave. I still get choked up about it. But I think the final like tipping point was when one of our fraternity brothers, we called little Jay, because I don't think he was more than like 85, 90 pounds, sat on the bed, and I woke up screaming from pain. And the president of the university had, this is back before we had real laptops. He took a laptop from a math teacher so that I can do schoolwork from the apartment that I was staying in. And, you know, this is back when we had VAX accounts in Mozilla, you know, not like the internet we have today.
No, dial up and wait 10 minutes.
I knew the day was coming, but I really didn't want to leave because everything I had planned for was in alignment, right? And my grades were in alignment. I was in the law I was in the 3+3 program, everything I wanted. And, you know, SUNY Albany is a perfect place for people who want to do politics, the city, capital of New York State. The school is extremely great, a wonderful school. I didn't get in. So the academics is pretty, people get in there have usually a higher academics than me. Let's put it that way. They're the A+ students. I'm like that A-B+ student. But I had a 3-page resume of extracurricular activities from high school and volunteerism. And I was already very active in government, local, state, and federal, right? So that I knew that's where I was going. I was very certain I was going to be in Congress by now. It was my dream to run for the United States. I fully expected to be Congresswoman. And, you know, that's not going to happen. Still get a little emotional about it. But, and I, the first time I advocated on the opposite side of the politician's office desk, I was bawling because I'm like, I'm supposed to be there, not here. So it was, you know, it was, my chum was with me too. So it was an emotional moment. Fortunately, the representative Lofgren spent like an hour with me. She was amazing. But it was, you know, it was really hard because that's where I had planned to be from a, probably by the time I was 14 or 15, I planned for career politics. Planned to be a social justice lawyer, planned to be in the civil rights arena. And I, you know, even in college, I was working in pro bono areas and the AIDS clinics and so forth, because I really wanted to serve underserved communities, whether it was education or ethnic background or racial background or socioeconomic or all of the above. Those were groups that were being underserved and were not getting proper legal representation, whether it was in civil rights, family law, or in criminal justice system. I mean, you could just look at our prisons, you can see the injustice and disparate impact of the legal system and the penal code on ethnic and minorities in our communities, right? And whether it's racial lines or economic lines, it's very clear in the prisons of how that penal code is delineated and the punishment. So that's where I was going. And that was 5 units away from that law degree, by the way. So that's still a thorn in my side. I know I can't sit for the bar, but gosh darn it, I went through hell during law school. I wheeled across that stage in my grandfather's gown, because he had a doctorate, so I wore his gown for crossing that stage. And yeah, they didn't let me finish my last 5 units, and it wasn't even my fault. The company making the compound for my pain pump created an overdose, and it significantly impacted my ability. Yeah, this again, where the Ehlers-Danlos was actually a benefit, because people with Ehlers-Danlos metabolize medication much faster, anesthetic much faster, or local anesthetic much faster.
And I think that, you know, it's really, it's so hard to like have to mourn something, you know, especially your future of what you thought you would get. Now, am I sitting here still thinking that each moment counted for you 100% because of your advocacy and what you're doing? Right. But obviously nothing takes away from that moment of what you were working for. And then so many things are just coming about that are completely out of your control. And I'm a complete control freak half the time.
And, I used to be so much now, but
you know what I'm talking about. And it's just like, when things like that keep happening, it's just like, boom, boom, like shot after shot per se. And, you know, being so close. Saying
that we have like this infinite amount of shoes waiting to drop above this house. It's just infinite amount, like just waiting for the next. At this point, it's, what's the next shoe gonna drop? Okay, here it is. All right, how can you get past this one now? All right, what was the next shoe gonna, like, it's just at this point, it's par for the course that something is going to happen. It's just a matter of if and when, not what. Like, you know, I mean, not when, you know, it's gonna happen. It's just, we don't know what, but something is going to happen, because nothing is ever stable on me. Every time we get to a point where we think it's stable, something else happens. You know, and then you got to get over that. And then you get there and then, oh, we're great. Even like right before I got that infection, I was like, oh, everything's great. I'm ready to do this podcast and I'm ready to do the business. And all of a sudden, I was in the hospital for 13 days, you know, and then
wow,
not that I was counting or anything.
I mean, literally, you've had to spend so much time in the hospital finding. Just, I love that you said that you're your own advocate, because you truly have to be when it comes to medical and writing stuff down. I want everyone who's listening to take a tip, write the stuff down that you need to take to go see your doctor, period. There's a lot of people that would sit there and make 10 excuses and not have to go through half of what you're going through. But I like too that you are willing to take on the different challenges. Like, you know, do we always want to sit there and wait for the other shoe to drop? No, you know, like gratitude and, you know, trying to position ourselves, but the same sense, like, you know, that you just moved and you're going to have to go through this transition. And I do like your mentality where you're like, I'll take it on. Like, me and my family, like, we take these things on together. And that's really, really important. Especially, you know, you marrying your high school sweetheart. I mean, how amazing is that too?
I wouldn't have met him if it hadn't been for the move, because I met him when I moved out to Arizona. So I never intended to leave New York State for education, partly because my parents had a rule that if we went to the state school, they would pay for that for the undergraduate. Anything beyond the cost of the state school was out of our own pocket or loans. We're not stupid. We're going to take that deal. And there's really good schools in New York. So my brother went to Albany. I went to Albany, not to follow my brother, but because I was a really good school for politics. He also was going to politics too. But, you know, he didn't do the law though, but he is in politics. And
I was going to ask, I was like, is he in politics or law right now?
Politics. He's not in law. He would be a great lawyer. And the difference here, where you're talking about the control thing, I was a really hardworking B+, A- student, knowing how to do that studying and studying those hours. And that just wasn't his forte in college. And so we'll just leave it at that. He's incredibly talented. He's a triathlon. He's a Ironman, as is his wife, you know, incredibly accomplished, but you know, the sit down structured schooling, not his forte in college. So you know, I was on this track and everything was going great. And then my body is like, oh, hell no, we're not going there. I'm like, oh, okay. And I tried to fight it until my body said, you're done. We're done. That's it. You know, like, you can't move any, because with the pressure changes, I would feel days in advance, whether it was rain or snow. In Albany, it was either raining or snowing like 3/4 of the year. So I was always in severe pain. And it wasn't a lifestyle that I could live anymore, right? And didn't do anything from. So when I moved, the May before moving out in that summer, we went out to see, try to find me an apartment, because my parents, the plan was to find me a furnished apartment, drive me out, leave me, and come back home, because they were in New York, right? So we found the apartment. I went to the campus, had to go get my email account. I had, because how could I live without email? Even then, Vax account and IRC, that was what we used. So yes, I'm dating myself a little bit, but that's okay. And I went in the computer lab. I just remember very distinctly, because my dad was with me and he knew nothing about computers at the time. We still know more than me.
Yeah, we definitely know more in that generation.
Not computers. And so I remember thinking, oh my God, if this guy talks to my dad, I'm going to just scream right now. You know, like when you go to a mechanic and they talk to the guy a lot of times, I'm like, if he talks to my dad, I'm going to like just be livid. But he didn't. He talked to me, didn't even interact with my dad, just completely talked with me. I was like, oh, okay, double thumbs up here. And so when it came out a few months later, I went to go up to get the space to be able to create a website. This is back when you actually wrote in HTML. And so he was impressed that a woman knew how to write in HTML, or that was even interested in creating a website. And we ended up hanging out that whole day, which is my parents' wedding anniversary. And we've been together ever since. And mind you, there's been a lot of ups and downs, but he's been my rock. He's been my guiding light through so much. And I'm not what he initially intended, right? Because he wanted to, you know, when he met me, I was going to law. I was physically, had challenges, but I was already interning in Attorney General's office. I was already doing mediation training. You know, I was very clearly dedicated to community service hours. I was already doing all of these things. And I had my plan, my 5-year, 10-year, 20-year plan, you know, and my dream was to run for president of the United States. I didn't expect to win, but I wanted to run and be somebody just to talk about somebody who was not a billionaire, who was running for president, who actually wanted to serve and be president. And you see, my nickname is Madam President, right? And actually, it's the title of my chapter of why I'm not president of the United States. And so there were ups and downs. When I came out, you know, I had gone with emotional roller coaster. As we moved it, as my dad was driving me out, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. So he literally had to drive me, drop me off, and fly back home because she needed to get, you know, treatment immediately. She had a large, like an 8-inch tumor that had grown that she had to have immediately, you know, removed and chemo for and everything else. And she's okay now and everything. But, you know, it was very traumatic. I remember that too, you know.
Yeah, because you don't know. I mean, now you can sit there and say, this is what has happened, but you have no idea. So you're at this time, you're in Arizona, and then you guys are in California, right?
So now. Right. My parents are in New York. And they dropped me, my dad dropped me off, flew back home to my mom. And then finished my last 2 years of undergraduate. And my husband finished right around the same time. So we actually had the same graduation ceremony. And then it was really cute. He finished technically in December and I finished in May, but we walked together. So there's some cute pictures of us in our caps and gowns together. So then we went to Phoenix for a year. Well, he worked at Motorola and I did my master's program at ASU. So we did that. The idea being is just in case I couldn't finish law school, I wanted a backup plan. And since I was already still playing on politics, my master's program was in education because one of my big platforms was the inequities and disparities of the education programs in the United States. Yeah. Because when they're based on income, it is really leaving a large part of the population disadvantaged. You're not getting the same teachers, you're not getting the same caliber, you're not getting the same education. It may be different in other states, but coming from New York, you need a regents degree to get in any of the main universities and most out-of-state schools too. The low income, I had the part of a program where we switched places with minority students in different school districts. So we had the opportunity to feel what it was like to be a minority, right? And I was like a white girl, obviously a white girl, but I went, for listeners who don't know, I'm a Caucasian woman. And I went into a school that was all African-American and Latino. And I was, along with a few other leaders, we were the only white individuals at the school. But we went to all the classes, we had peer students that we worked with, and we switched places to really have that real conversation, that real understanding of one another. And it was incredibly eye-opening because they did not have enough teachers for Regents programs. And you can't get, even when I transferred from Albany to Arizona, and I had a 3.67, I still needed to show my Regents degree to the University of Arizona from SUNY Albany. I'm going, are you serious? But, and it's not that U of A is bad, but SUNY Albany is a different caliber of academic requirements. And I just was shocked to see that. But even more so, the impact that I saw on my fellow students that, you know, I had a job where I had a lot of work study students that were we all worked together in the information desk and student union. And I was seeing the lack of support for students that came in from schools with low-income communities, and they didn't have the same kind of educational background. I had one summer class that was nothing to have a student had 800 in the SAT and a student had 1500 in the SATs, right? And there's a big obvious difference in the concepts of the verbiage of the things that are being used in the language that is used, and in a school where blue books is a common use for tests, and it's seeing multiple choice tests until I went to U of A. Like, what is this thing? You know, blue books is how you did everything. So
gosh, and that was back then. I still think it's bad now.
And so language mattered, right? And so all of that influenced my desire to have the education platform from when I went to politics, because I wanted to represent the disparity of education, create inclusive programs, especially in higher education, retention, but recruitment, but real retention programs, not like some silly little summer class, real support for people, especially if they're coming from homes where there's not somebody who already has a degree, right? Because that matters. The number one thing that impacts somebody's education is the education of their mother, right? And then the next thing is the community. Is there somebody close to that person who finished some type of trade school, higher education, something, right? Then the comes of money. And then, you know, there's a couple of other elements, but those were big issues. And of course, cultural issues too. So that was really where I did my graduate degree. Still went to law school. So my husband at the time, I actually had just given him back an engagement ring. because I did not feel as good enough to be a wife. Mainly because, you know, at that point, my pain management wasn't under control. I was vomiting 10, 20 times a day, if not more, because they were not giving me pain treatment the right way. And so I couldn't move without vomiting. I mean, it was like, you go to the bathroom and vomit. And when you get an ice pack, you vomit. Like, is it worth getting an ice pack for the vomiting? You know, you had to like figure that out. And I remember just, you know, he had an office that was where he used to game and everything. And I remember giving back the ring and just saying, you know, I know what you wanted. You want an independent woman capable of taking care of herself, self-sufficient and strong and powerful. And I'm not any of those things anymore. So I gave him back the ring. Of course he stayed with me, but I gave him back the ring. And his intention originally was to come out to California with me for 1 year to make sure I got started in my law program. Because he wanted to make sure, even if we couldn't be together, he wanted to make sure I started what he knew where I really wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And so he obviously didn't leave because he's still here. And, you know, we had our wedding renewal ceremony 5 years ago last November. And I was diagnosed with the last sort of myasthenia gravis 3 months before our wedding renewal ceremony. So, you know, he still renewed the vows with me, knowing, you know, I have a total mess of a body and cognitive and breathing, but hey, you know.
Well, first of all, there's more to you than that. Like, you have an amazing personality, you know that, and you are so, so strong. But I didn't realize it was only 5 years ago. And can you pronounce it for me? Because I'm terrible at this.
Don't worry, it took me a really long time. Myasthenia gravis. And so myasthenia is I should have had it come up on my image here. M-Y-S-T-H-E-N-I-A. But the listeners can't see that. So it's M-Y-A-S-T-H-E-N-I-A. And a separate word is gravis, G-R-A-V-I-S. And that's another autoimmune disorder. And it's the body attacks receptors from the brains to the muscles. It actually means grave muscular weakness in Latin. It's in the same, it's under the umbrella of muscular dystrophy. It's in the same family as MS, and it's not like ALS, but it has a lot of similar symptoms. And so my breathing can be affected. My speech gets very slurred at times. My vision will get double visioned. I'll have a hard time focusing on things. I get severe muscular weakness from just feeling like 1,000 pounds on me. I can't barely move or pick up laundry or pick up myself up. There have been times my husband had to pick me up off the ground. And so it compounds the Ehlers-Danlos. And I also have dysautonomic dysfunction. So that's when I lose my consciousness because my blood pressure will drop really low. And then
you lose consciousness?
I lose consciousness very frequently. It's actually why I have this, besides now the kidney problems, I also have the IV fluids because I cannot drink enough for somebody who has POTS. So it's postural tachycardia, orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And it's getting a little bit more well known now because a lot of people with long haul COVID are having POTS symptoms. So now it's getting a little bit more known. POTS isn't really a rare disease. And it can go with a lot of other disorders or autoimmune conditions. And with Ehlers-Danlos, there's this beautiful Venn diagram of secondary comorbidity diseases. And I can pretty much check off almost everything. So, I went to the EDS conference. And I'm like, yep. And I remember right before the conference, mom was going, everything can't be tied to Ehlers-Danlos. And I'm going, well, you know, I don't know. Came back from the conference, go, oh, yeah, you see, look. And I had this chart of all these second comorbidities, from gastroparesis to pelvic floor dysfunction, to the breathing problems, to the POTS, the vision. My heart, fortunately, is not yet, not affected, not yet, just not affected. I'm not gonna manifest, not yet. It's not affected. It could be because anything in the body where there's connective tissue, once it stretches, won't go back. We just don't. So if you think of like a rubber band, when you stretch it, it goes back again. Well, Ehlers-Danlos people, once it stretches, it does not go back again. It doesn't show, but there's over more than 20% of people can have myasthenia without it showing up that way. And I just, you know, they've done these wonderful nerve conductive tests that test to see how tired your muscles get in the reactions. And I react right away. And like my eyes will droop shut or my arm will not be able, I mean, there's a lot of not so fun tests that they've done to show that I have it, but it's been a journey. And even that one, I you know, that's when the story, right, is that first part of the chapter, I talk about waking up and barely being able to talk, sounding like I had a stroke, looking like I had a TIA, looking like I had a mini stroke. The whole left side of my face was shut down and my eyes were almost shut down. And, you know, the doctor didn't really say anything about it. I took a picture and even just showed this last doctor who doesn't, who was arguing with him whether or not I have it. And I showed her the picture. She's like, oh, maybe you should mail that to me. I'm like, okay, fine. And doctor ended up missing my, one, the first thing I said was, oh, you look worse in person than the picture. Picture my eyes practically shut. So I don't know how else it could have looked any worse, you know, because this side of my face doesn't move anymore. It used to be like a big old smile. This is my biggest smile I could get, you know, unless I'm laughing, then I usually can get a little bit extra energy into it. But in general, it doesn't go much bigger than that. My eyes are much more drooped than they used to be, much more slurred speech, which is why I really had a hard time public speaking after all of this started to take place, and part of why I got into Clubhouse. Actually, the number one reason why I got into Clubhouse. And one other person goes, oh, well, you might have this. He goes, but I wasn't really looking for anything rare. I'm looking, I'm going, what did you just say? He's like, oh, I didn't really look into it because I didn't want to look for, I wasn't looking for anything rare. I'm going, you realize I'm a zebra already with a rare disease. It's like, that actually makes me more prone to rare diseases. They found this correlation. Once you have one, you are more likely for other ones because you have autoimmune deficiencies and can easily have other autoimmune disorders. So needless to say, he wasn't looking at my doctor, right? Because
yeah, I mean, wow.
Rare when I already had multiple rare diseases, I was kind of looking and going, I don't know what you're thinking, but we're not obviously on the same page here.
At all.
Right. And, you know, for me, it isn't even about diagnosis. It's what can you do to make it so that I can be as functional as possible, right? I can't drive anymore. I get that. I can't hold a full-time job, but I still want to make a difference, right? And that's, you know, part of why I started the, helped start the nonprofit here is I want to still contribute. I've been a servant leader my whole life. I've always wanted to be a servant leader. I mean, I wasn't going to politics for money. I was going into politics because I wanted to make a change. I wasn't going to law for money. And I knew that when I signed my student loans, it even showed me like the kind of law I want to go into. My husband makes it as a software engineer. And it's like, okay, your 4 degree is going to make more than my, you know, college graduate and law degree together. But I'm doing this for what I can do with it to represent a community that is not normally represented. Yeah. And so I knew that. And so here I was, my body's failing me. And what do I do? So it's been this past 10 years of trying to find where do I fit in now, right? Because I don't have an official title for years. I got off of LinkedIn because after the law degree and I couldn't finish it, I did have 2 children. I had at least 2 back surgeries, 3 neck surgeries, 2 pump surgeries, 3 port surgeries, and some other things in the past 10 years and something else, but I've lost count by now. And so, you know, when they ask me, which ones, you know, somewhere there I had a breast reduction too and some other things. So yeah. I've kind of lost, you know, count of all the other things and hospitalizations and infections and all that other stuff. And I still want to do something. And how do I do that? And how do I feel of value this community of people that have disabilities that for so long have been isolated, for so long have been told we cannot do? How do we change that narrative? How do we change that dialogue? And it's twofold, right? Because you have to change it for people that have disabilities. You have to teach people, I am powerful, I am strong, I can do this, I am of value, right? And that is so important, but you also have to teach the business end. So trying, you know, that's why, even though it seems very broad, it's why I have 2 major elements for variability is to make sure we are honoring caring for people with disabilities while creating space at the table for diversity with people with disabilities and diversity within that population, right? Because often advocates are, as I'm learning now, you know, women of color would tell me they've had even a harder time for medical care, not just for good medical.
Yeah, medical period is absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. Marcus's family goes through it in so many different ways and has truly opened up, you know, my eyes through what they've had to go through. And gosh, I think about all the times I worried about going and then seeing all of this happen, which is why I'm glad that you are being an advocate for inclusion, diversity, and I love that you're you're sitting here having the conversation with me that you too have had other conversations to open your eyes to that too. And I think that's so, so important, especially for the people listening. Like, it is our responsibility to learn about the world around us and what others have to go through in so many ways. Yeah. And no one has to teach us. It is definitely our responsibility to go out and get the information.
And that's something that, you know, so when I started learning more about bringing, you know, the cert round, you know, almost full circle, right? Where I've always wanted to work for underserved communities.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like stalking people on LinkedIn going, oh, you're an advocate. So, and I would see, you know, when I was talking to some of these women and actually create a panel last fall. And one of the women, she's a woman of color, and told me, so this was in the United States, a woman who is she's a physician assistant and was told by doctors that she has a higher pain tolerance because she's a woman of color. She's actually African American. And so I was floored, and she wasn't the first one to hear the story from. And this was last year. I'm hearing these stories. I'm going, like, are we in the 21st, what century are we in here? I'm like, you know, and
right, because I've heard of it before. I've heard of, you know, testing before and it has happened. I'm literally cringing inside that is still the mentality that doctors even have, who are supposed to be, one, based off quote unquote science and, like, you know, medical and all of that stuff. And it's just like,
absolutely,
like, it truly breaks my heart, because there's so many things that can go wrong, happen to a human, period, mm-hmm. let alone have doctors, nurses, anything, see a different point of view and then put your life at risk because of it. What do you mean?
And then you have the mental health aspect. Yeah, the pain tolerance, and you have the mental health aspect, because there's no way,
yeah,
you have pain, you're going to have the mental health aspect. It does not necessarily mean you have to go speak to a counselor, although many people do, and there's absolutely welcome that. Or I have a whole wall here of my crafting supplies, and actually behind me as well, this whole room is full of crafting supplies. This is my mental health room. And so my husband's like, this is a very sensitive room you got here. Like, well,
you have to create that space though, because I mean, who else is going to create it? It's not like you go to the hospital and feel comfortable. It's not like you walk into somewhere and feel comfortable. And I mean, to sit there and be going through all of this, including COVID coming in, having, you know, just even the fear of getting it, and, you know, the ideas that would come with that of like what could happen is obviously a very like fear-based to live in.
It impacts my kids dramatically. I mean, my younger son, because when school started this year, he was so eager to go back to school, and it was his first day back, and it was actually his first day at the school. And he came home his first day and asked to stay home because he didn't want to get me sick. And he was too young to get the vaccine, and he didn't want to get me sick. So he was so gung-ho to go to school, and then everybody was like on top of each other, sharing supplies. And he comes home that night. He was really upset. He didn't want to tell me at first, right? Because he didn't want me to be upset, which I thought was really sweet. But, you know, that's, you know, and then of course I had to spend the next week trying to find a virtual school for him, because when we moved here, school was literally starting the next week or 2 weeks later. I mean, it was like really right on top of it. And so he's doing virtual schooling. And then with this latest Omicron rise, my older son, who was in person schooling, he'll be 16 in February.
Wow.
He has to do virtual schooling at least until, well, he's doing independent study right now, until hopefully things settle down a little bit. Otherwise, I'll have to pull him out and do a different plan. And again, it's not for them. They're doing it to protect me. And so, you know, the mom part of me, it breaks my heart that my kids have to think that way. I mean, it's really sweet in one element. I love that they're empathetic and they're caring, and they check on me, you know, and they bring me food or water, and you know, just like, if I'm quiet for a long time, they'll come to see if I'm okay. So it's really sweet, and they're very empathetic and they're very supportive, and they're my biggest cheerleaders. I mean, even when I was, you know, when I used to do adaptive taekwondo, they would sit there with the video cameras and they would be like recording me and cheering me on. They've always been my cheerleaders. Aww. And you know, the first to defend me or protect me or help me and everything. So, but they've also had to see things that no child should have to see. I mean, I think my only
repeatedly. Son,
Yeah, right. And I think it was 11 one of the times when I was unconscious and he couldn't wake me up. And then I finally woke up and I was trying to say, don't call 911. All that came out, nah, 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 nah. And then he's calling my husband, you know? And so I don't know how many times they see me in an ambulance. And honestly, my service dog has been so not, he is so used to them now that the last time the ambulance came, the paramedics like, oh, is he going with you or your husband? And I'm like, with me. And he just like jumped right into that ambulance. Like, didn't even think twice. He's like, oh, okay, I'll let it. Okay, that is either a really well-trained dog or a dog that's been in an ambulance too often. And so, you know, they've all been through this and seen so many times where I'm not functioning. I mean, even in Hanukkah, where I couldn't get out of bed and we're using a virtual menorah to light on my laptop. Last year we did lighting on the bed and it's not something I'd recommend. So we found a virtual menorah that you could actually move the candle mm-hmm. to the different candles. And that's how we lit the candles most of the time. Mm-hmm. So they adapt. They support me. Sometimes put me to bed if they think I'm doing too much. They'll take my iPad away, my phone away, and like they'll like wheel me to the bedroom and go, you're done. They have taken me home. Yeah, a scout event once by our house. And apparently I was slurring a lot more than I realized. And my son's like, no, you're done. You're not going anywhere else. You're done. And I was taking photos of an event. It was like a holiday thing. And I was supposed to be on duty for the next hour. He's like, you're done. And he literally pushed me home. He's like, I'm making this executive decision. You're done, Mom. And so they are very protective. They are very supportive. And even at scout camp, you know, my older son would go and bring me the meals. And only did I learn the last day of camp that he was actually having to go through the line every meal twice. He went through the adult line to get me food. Then he went to the kid scout line every single meal. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me? I would have gotten, you know, but he wanted to make sure he could find something that he thought I might eat. And since I have a problem finding things to eat, between my stomach issues, between my nausea issues, and between being picky eater and kosher style, I'm not an easy person to feed. And so he was trying to find things he thought I might eat. And so, you know, he's being so sweet about it and he didn't want to say anything. So it was very sweet, but it's an example again of my kids have grown up way more, I think, than other kids have, because you know, they've seen me so many times go in the hospital or doing not too well in the hospital. And, you know, another thing happened, like the paramedics came, what happened now, Mom? You know, and so that's just, you know, that's our reality, but it's a juggling act. It really is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm very passionate about creating a space for people to grow. And it's also this year why I applied for the Miss Wheelchair competition and why I'm doing the Miss Wheelchair USA. I'm officially Miss Wheelchair California USA. So for the next, for 2022, that's my title. I have a little crown. It's actually a big crown. I have a big crown. And part of that is social media advocacy work, my platform. And part of it is for at least four virtual or in-person events a month, mm-hmm. which if anybody needing somebody to come and do something, let me know, because I am definitely looking for opportunities to share my story, but also highlight other people's stories and just show people you can be beautiful in a chair, you can be beautiful standing, you can be beautiful with braces, without braces. It's who you are that matters. It's not, you know, the whole package of, you know, how far can you run or how far can you walk, you know. And for me, it's been a very progressive, right? So I'm in a constant flux. And so that is really what I'm trying to accomplish with my mission, with my communications, and why I'm striving to work on my public speaking. And I am all over the place on Clubhouse and these other apps to really, you know, create that space for us to be seen and heard, and not just in the disability community. It's valid, it's important, but it's also important outside of that group too.
The work that you have been doing and the voice, like, you truly, when you speak, it is very, very strong. Like, the ear goes right to it to listen to what you say. And I think, gosh, everything that you were training for, this was not the outcome, but it has played again. It's the journey. The journey has literally led you here. And now writing, I also think this chapter and even this book gives people an outline, like this is what someone has gone through. is still going through, and it's not sugarcoating. You know, you're like, when I wrote this, like, I was crying, and I have been there, because my first episode of season 3 was 11 minutes and it took me 4 hours because I was bawling, because it's so much of reliving traumas. It's no matter if you're in a healed place, when you have to relive something, it definitely takes over. And going through your own healing with it too. So I would definitely recommend people to write, whether you want to put it as a book or your journal or getting to know yourself. I think it's really important. And I want to also touch on the fact that you said, you'll say fake it till you make it, but if you step into who you truly want to be, that is who you are. Like, you are being that person. And a lot of people don't think that they have that power at all, or that they're capable or worthy or deserving to step and be them and to show up in so many different areas, because we don't need to see the same person twice. We need to sit there and meet different people and open our minds on so many different levels, especially mental health, because you're talking about PTSD. You're talking about fear because of the world that we're living in. And I can just say that I know that the community surround you, because we all see what you're doing. Like, you are our president. Like, you are speaking, seriously, you are speaking more truth than anyone. So I wouldn't normally ask what is next, but you have the Sound Bowls going, you got a podcast, which you're going to let us know is when it's going to air. And can you tell everyone where to go and follow you and your website?
Yes. So I'm on Instagram. I'm Crafts on Wheels. I'm also on LinkedIn, and I have a website at Rare Ability at www.rareability.org. And also, if anybody wants a sponsor, I am looking for sponsors for the Miss Wheelchair USA competition. So they have personal sponsors, right? Because there's a link I actually have in my link tree on my bio. Direct way to donate to the Miss Wheelchair competition. And which, by the way, the foundation that runs it is a nonprofit that helps support people with developmental disabilities, in particular families with children with developmental disabilities. Okay. So they really are striving to help empower, engage, and support families. And so I do have to raise funds for my actual cost for the competition. And then, of course, all of the other things like the clothing and the transportation, all that's on me. The national competition is in July, which will be a 10-day competition. Not quite sure they've matched that one yet. That seems really overwhelming right now. So I'm just taking this a little bits. But, you know, so there's that. And then there's my nonprofit. And then, of course, if people want to do coaching or they want to do mindfulness programs or a sound bath, all of that can be scheduled on the website. And or you message me on Instagram, Facebook. I'm on Clubhouse, I'm on Fireside, I'm on Wisdom, I'm on Twitter, just started TikTok, and YouTube. Yeah, so I kind of got them all covered at this point.
Yeah, you're getting your voice and message everywhere. I mean, and there's so many different platforms as well. And I'm actually going to put everything, including where to donate. I'm just going to put a direct link down in the show notes to make it really easy for them to sponsor you, to reach out to you, especially for your coaching, because I just want to support you in any way possible. I think what you're doing is absolutely amazing. And if you are listening to this, please let us know. Reach out to both of us, actually. Let us know what you really took from this episode, and maybe even some things that you're struggling with that, you know, we can really just love on you for. So go follow Deborah. Like, subscribe, and follow her journey. Donate and sponsor her, okay? Don't buy me a coffee this week. Go ahead and sponsor her for her journey as well. And then go over to Crystal Ball, like, subscribe, push the buttons, and do the things. And I will see you next week for a brand new episode. Goodbye. Thanks.